So this is intended to be a discussion on infrared effects, quantum effects, in De Sitter space. So there are a lot of things that one could say here, and I don't know how far I'll get through this, but just to give you some basis, well, basically, I put on the wiki page for the non-equilibrium program two references. One of them is a review article myself and collaborators. And a second, this contains many references. And a recent paper by Sasha Polyakov, which raises some of these very same issues again. And this is on the archive, originally posted around September, and then a second version in December. So we've been discussing this sort of on and off here, and it seemed like it might be an interesting thing to go over these issues again. Some of them are actually quite old. These references contain things like papers that I wrote in 1985 when I was a postdoc here. And so some of that is well known, maybe some of it isn't well known. So I thought maybe we should sort of start from the beginning, and we'll see how far we get. So it is a discussion though, so let's please interrupt me. So of course, why do you care about the space? Well, it's basically because, well, one would like to understand the cosmological constant, or now we have a more fashionable phrase called dark energy. Okay, so as you all know, if taken at face value, the supernova data suggests that something like 70% of the energy in our universe is, in fact, dark energy, with rho lambda equal negative pressure. Okay, so one has actually reasonable bounds on this now from the data. It's still, of course, up to further observations to confirm this. But taken at face value, we actually live in something that's not so far away from De Sitter space. So that's another reason to think about this. If you take the data at face value, 70% of the closure density means this in Hubble units. This is the present value of the Hubble expansion time. And of course, what is 70% of the Hubble scale ends up being about 10 to the minus 120 in Planck units. So if you worry about hierarchies, this is, of course, the biggest hierarchy problem of them all. So let me start by making a few comments just about vacuum energy, because, of course, you can think of this, and this, you know, has a fascinating history, which I'm sure someone who has looked at the history of physics could make a very interesting talk about that all by itself. You know, it goes back to Pauli's observation that if you took the zero-point energy of quantum theory seriously, that you would, of course, expect a vacuum energy of roughly like the number of degrees of freedom in integration over momentum times the vacuum energy for each mode. And of course, this is very badly divergent and leads to something which goes like the number of degrees of freedom over some minimum. If I cut this off at some 1 over L min, then this behaves like a fourth power of 1 over L min. So this means that you have, in the naive calculation in flat space, extreme sensitivity to the ultraviolet. Although we should point out from the very beginning that this is not something that we measure in ordinary physics, so the best example of vacuum fluctuations in the laboratory is the Casimir effect. And you all know the famous calculation of Casimir of two conducting plates, which are a distance of d apart. And of course, you don't find a diverging energy here. Well, you do if you do it naively, but you have to be more careful and subtract that. And what you find is a much smaller effect, which is this famous 1 over d fourth. So notice what happened, that when you actually do the calculation with the correct boundary conditions and subtract off the formally divergent energy of the vacuum, you get a perturbed vacuum energy due to the boundary conditions of the plates, which is in which this ultraviolet scale, L min, is replaced by the infrared scale of the plates themselves. And of course, this is small, finite, and measurable. So already suggests at this very naive level that one should not be thinking about this divergent quantity, but one should be thinking about deviations from that quantity depending on the conditions you're in the universe. Okay, so that's just a remark to get going. So now, let's think about, basically this shows that these measurable effects are infrared effects. Right? The scale D is macroscopic. It can be as big as you want. Of course, if it's too big, you're not going to see the effect, but it has nothing whatsoever to do with ultraviolet cutoffs. Okay, so that's one way to think about why infrared effects. Yeah.
What about the scale of the weak scale, right? I mean, in some sense, the weak scale is a perturbation like D, that would something happen that generates that.
Yeah.
So is the weak scale an infrared effect or a UV effect in your situation?
I would say it's an UV effect. Because
it's not negligible because it's playing the role. Something happened at the weak interaction time that had energy.
Yeah, so you have to calculate. So if you want to look at the expansion of the universe as you go through that scale, of course, there's going to be a change in the vacuum energy at that scale.
Yeah, the fact that the weak interaction vacuum is so non-trivial.
If n changes, of course, then you have the number of degrees of freedom change.
No, it's not a question of number of degrees of freedom. I mean, we don't see that. They're not present at low energy, but they're virtual. I think what you're implying is that the virtual effects of phases don't affect the vacuum energy that we see.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. This is good.
Wrong, right? Phenomenologically. Okay, so you can take that as a. Yeah.
There's another way of viewing the which makes the dependence of the distance between the plates of the effect. You can equally write calculate this point.
That's right. Here. That's we're never going to get to anything like that here.
Yeah,
so,
but I should remember that the reason
correct.
That long-range forces has to do with the fact that there are indeed
right.
Long-range forces in nature, which are electrical constituents, electrical
Everything, I absolutely agree. And in that case, everything's under physical control, and you can look at it exactly as the induced dipole-dipole interaction.
Someone misstated the call for an effect, or it's just a natural scale.
Well, I don't want to argue about misleading, but it is certainly a fact, right, that this force has nothing to do with any ultraviolet cutoff. That's the only statement I want to make. So, great. We're going to have a lively discussion. So, okay. that's the point, right? But I do want to try to get to what I think are the main issues. So, we'll see how it goes. All right. So, let's talk now about the sitter space. Okay. So, this is all familiar stuff, but basically, there are several different ways of writing the sitter space in different coordinates. So this is one you often see because it's nice, it has spatially flat sections, and so you can do a lot of your standard stuff there. Inflationary people, for example, like that. But it's not so great in the sense that it covers only part of the manifold. The H here is, of course, this is the Robertson-Walker scale factor. I'm using T bar here because I want to reserve T for a different time. So, of course, this is just solving the Friedman equation with a vacuum energy proportional to lambda. This is just lambda over 3, okay, where I put C equal 1. Okay, so this is one version of Friedman-Robertson-Walker coordinates. Another version, which is the same, exactly the same line element, and I'll call it tau now. So I just want to write down some formula so we don't lose track of what we're talking about. So this exhibits the spatial sections as three spheres. So the sitter is actually, that's a poor diagram, isn't it? The sitter is actually a hyperboloid of revolution. So it's a space of constant positive curvature with my conventions, and is each slice at tau equals constant is a three-sphere. Okay, so that's what this picture is meant to represent. Time, tau, time is going up this way, slicing through these three spheres. Okay, so that's one way of writing it. There's another way of writing it, and I just want to record this, is in a static coordinates. You'll see why this is relevant, I hope. Here I call it T. So here, these are two spheres, and here this exhibits the horizon, the fact that there's a certain, if the observer is put at R equals 0, he has an apparent horizon at 1 over H, which is just the statement that he's just sitting here, and basically light waves are from the other half of the space are unable to reach him. So finally, one can put this in a Penrose-Carter diagram like this, and this you'll find in all the books. So tau equals infinity is up here, and the slicings through at constant tau are just horizontal slices, but this time coordinate T runs like this here, and only covers this one wedge. And in fact, it runs backwards on the other side. So this is the time-like Hilling field d by dt. Okay, so that's just the geometry of the sitter space, which is very standard. Now what we want to talk about are quantum effects in this background. So I want to discuss quantum field theory in the sitter space. And we're starting to get closer to some of the issues raised in these recent papers. So, of course, as is well known in field theory in any curved space, is not there's no unique vacuum state, unlike Minkowski space, where you have a well-defined vacuum, which you can think of as being annihilated by positive frequency excitations. So what you'd like to do in a canonical treatment, right, is expand, say, a scalar field operator in some set of modes, labeled here just generically by I, and define a state which is annihilated by the annihilation operator I, AI. Yeah, for the moment, but we're going to talk about interactions, hopefully, before we get on, because that's part of the point. Okay, so these are just solutions of the wave equation, of course. Let's stay with free fields for a moment. And the problem, of course, is that there are lots of ways, there are lots of solutions of the wave equation if you take this background as an example, but really in almost any background, you're going to have some decision to make about what are the fields you're going to call phi I and what are the phi I star. In other words, you don't know a priori what the positive frequency solutions are. Like you know in flat space, you're going to take in flat space this to just be e to the I omega p, where omega p is p squared plus m squared in flat space. And this basically gives you a unique decomposition into positive and negative frequencies and gives you a unique vacuum state, okay, if you think of it in the canonical way. So, I haven't stated any, right? But sure. Sure. There are alternative ways of doing it, right? And you get the same answer. Yes. This is a canonical. Yeah. In principle, yeah, of course. Yeah. But that's just the point. You don't really know what to do here. Yeah. Okay. So that's, well, that's what's going to be the next statement. Okay. So there is this space has a lot of symmetry. You know, I just want to say, in general, you don't have symmetries, right? So you don't really know what to do. And you know, we have a program here on non-equilibrium field theory, and the way one would approach it there is by some sort of initial value formulation in which you then evolve, because you don't necessarily, in any background, have particular symmetries. Right. Now, in this space, of course, if we're trying to do quantum field theory in this space without any perturbations on it, then, of course, this space is a lot of symmetry. It's a hyperboloid of revolution. It's a solution of Einstein's equations in which the curvature is constant everywhere. So you can think of this embedding in a five-dimensional embedding space, and then you'll see that this hyperboloid just has a 041 symmetry group, which the one means one of the directions has to be time-like in the embedding space. This is the Lorentzian flat space embedding of hyperboloid. Okay? So, indeed, what is usually done, and it's called a bunch Davies, or kind of version of Hoddle-Hawking vacuum, is to assume this symmetry. So forget for the moment about this, as you just said. One could do it that way, but one could also just demand that Green's functions Wightman functions or in general Feynman functions behave like, let's make this a Feynman function, are in fact 041 invariant. So let me call this the Bunch-Davies, or Polyakov calls it Euclidean. We can call it Euclidean as well. Okay, why Euclidean? Because the way you can define this most elegantly and rapidly is by continuing this one time-like direction to space-like one, and then instead of a hyperboloid, you have a sphere, a four-sphere. So under Euclidean continuation, the Sitter hyperboloid becomes, I don't know what I should use for that, becomes a four-sphere, and the group, of course, is 05. Everything Euclidean then. And then you know how to calculate Green's functions on 05, right? On S4, you just basically demand that everything is a function of the invariant distance on the sphere. So you have two points, and you know that the geodesics are great circles, and you can basically require that this function be a function only of that invariant distance. And if you do that, that turns the second order equation for this Feynman function into an ordinary differential equation in terms of this variable. And there are two solutions, but you can pick out which solution by demanding that it have the right short distance singularity and no other singularity. Okay. So you can either do it by mode functions, or you can do it by this kind of geometric construction, and you get a well-defined function, which, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't bother to write down, but I will. So not surprisingly, when you're dealing with spheres, you're going to get Legendre functions, and this is just the particular Legendre function that satisfies the right equations and right boundary conditions, and gamma here is just something that depends on the ratio of the mass of the field to the Hubble radius, to H. I'm trying to assiduously avoid using the word vacuum, but the state. Yeah.
Here.
Right. Right. So that's the group theory state you want it. Right. Okay. Yes. I mean, there are other.
Any other possibility you're involved in a state that's
Or will involve additional singularities besides the usual short distance one.
No, I'm worried about the state.
Yeah, me too.
Green functions in that state have to do other things. They're still discussing the state.
Yes. Yes.
So will other alternatives involve states that are not invariant under the
population? Or
not more.
Yeah. No, the answer is not quite. No. No. Okay, so let me make the statement about Green's functions and then translate it to your language. Okay? As I said, if you demand just invariance, of course you get a second order equation for this Green's function, which always has two solutions. This is the unique solution which has the right short distance behavior. But you can have a second solution which has antipodal. Okay. Yes?
But David, at this point, there's no hope, right? What do you mean there's no hope? If I some field theory defined as some functional interval on a force field,
you don't have.
Well, that's a prescription to construct things that they're supposed to be, make it sound easier than others. I don't know what I'm doing. There is a description for constructing transition elements in that Hubbard study.
We're not yet to transitions.
Well,
we're not. Well, we're not yet at transition elements, right?
But I'm doing quantum theory.
Free quantum field theory.
Well, anyway, call me more than one of those fucking things. There might be. That would be great. And indeed, it's here, and there's a deep vacuum. I found that in the rotation, so I was just bound to be in pain. In fact, maybe a continuous number. I just want to make it clear. I mean, I...
Now, Ron, what are you getting at? I am demanding it, but it is not the unique state which has that invariance. At the linearized level, if you just look at the generators. So you have these 10 generators for this group.
And
O5.
The question is, space and so forth, in the given Hilbert space that contains the O5 invariant state that in all this talk about nuclear frequency and all that, it is the unique O5 invariant state in that Hilbert space. The other O5 invariant states, what these things are called helper vacua, we have heard of them some years ago, they have all bunny shortest of properties, they're singular in other senses, they don't lie in the same Hilbert space, but you can talk about them as states in some general sense. This is the technical issue that Dimmel is...
I'm trying to not get deep into, but...
Also, the discussion so far, maybe you're going to get to this, the discussion so far is very perturbative in culture.
It's free, so far.
Yeah. And, you know, presumably, when you formulate the description of the states, you may well have to do that in a non-perturbative framework.
Well, we are. Some of the things that are raised, say, in the Polyakov paper, are about perturbation theory. So we can address some of the questions in a perturbative framework.
Some of them, there's a related component, and that is that so far, well, in the context of the gauge symmetry of gravity, you're not
perturbation. No, this is a global symmetry, not local gauge invariant. I mean,
yeah. So when we plot, well, we have to think about what the right gauge invariant quantities are, which is a thing as well.
Sure. Good. Shall I continue, or no? Go ahead. No, tell me. I mean, there are so many points we can raise here and go in many different directions. So I'm happy to do that, but we may not. We may not then get to the questions. So. So, okay. Well, gamma is real, as you see, if the mass is big enough, bigger than this critical value of 9/4. So it's another question. If the mass is bigger than this value, so that gamma is real, everything is fine, and this is a well-behaved state. If you look at light fields, in which the mass is less than this, you have to be more careful. There are certain issues that arise with the massless limit. I'll try to talk about that.
If this level is basically the case,
you can't. Right. Yeah. I mean, okay, so, yeah, I think... When gamma becomes imaginary, basically different representations of the group are involved. So these are the standard continuous representations of the group. But the fact that a number like this appears is telling you that this is a different group than you usually encounter, you know, the Poincaré group in flat space. You don't see any such kind of thing. And this is telling you something about the group theory representations of this non-compact group. So there is a continuous representations for gamma positive and real, and which are unitary and everything is good. If gamma becomes imaginary, you get other kinds of representations you have to be careful about. Yeah. All right. So good. Now, this is the state, of course, everybody uses. And it has these good properties and seems very natural. So a number of us, I include myself in this, and more recently...
This is the one
that Right. Well, I think there's some issues. Okay, and that's what we're going to discuss. Okay, so there are so many issues that I didn't really quite know how to get at this, so I started to think about looking at an analogy, which I think is actually a pretty good analogy. And that is, so let's take an aside at the risk of losing you about the sitter space. I want to make an example, an analogy. And that is constant, uniform electric field. So now we're going to do QED, not gravity, okay? But there's a background field, E, which is a constant everywhere in space and time. Now that's, as you know, a perfectly good solution to Maxwell's equations in vacuum. So we can even push the analogy a little farther and ask ourselves why there isn't a big electric field here in this room of cosmological origin. Why is it that the only fields we see are local, coming from local charges? So if you like an abuse of language, I could call that the cosmological electric field problem. Very good question. It does. No, it turns out you can actually construct with a constant uniform field a 10-dimensional group. With 10 generators, which has the same structure as the Poincaré group. That's another mathematical
pure
aside.
Electromagnetism.
Yeah.
Because in pure electromagnetism, before you turn this on, you had not a 10-dimensional group, but you had a 15-dimensional.
Yeah, no.
So you've broken that down to 10 dimensions.
I mean, the Poincaré group. Well, here you don't have a conformal group either. This,
I'm just saying.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
The 10 dimension is a right 10.
10
group.
Right.
Symmetry.
Yeah.
It doesn't impress me because you started before you turned on DE with 50.
Why do you call? But that's true here also.
No, in Kautsky space and the Sitter space.
The Sitter space has five conformal.
The Bernoulli Poincaré group.
Yeah.
And the Sitter space and Bernoulli Poincaré group. They have 15.
No. No. It's five. It's 5 times 4 divided by 2. It's 10. 10 generators. There are 10 symmetry generators. There is no conformal group.
And there are 10 in the Minkowski.
There are 10 in the Poincaré group.
There are 10 and there are 10. You haven't lost them. Whereas here,
but you're counting the conformal. If you count the conformal transformations, then I've also lost 5. It's exactly the same.
You haven't lost the neither Minkowski space or massive. If you were doing massive scalar field theory in Minkowski space.
Yeah. There wasn't any conformal appearance anyway.
But I'm just saying, then you say, aha, I have Maxwell's equations, transformations, 10 parameters, and when I turn on an E, I don't lose any.
Right.
But I say you are losing something. You're obviously losing something, and then you're miscounting, because when you have Maxwell's equations in flat space with no background fields, you have 15 generators.
For massive fields? Where's the
Maxwell's equations are conformal.
Maxwell's equations, yeah. But Einstein's equations are not conformal, right? Right? So I don't quite agree.
All I'm saying is, right. You said you turned on a background field.
But you know, I'm going to talk about quantum field theory in this background. So there is no conformal invariance. I think
so the reason you happened to find Ken Jennings when you started turning on something that's first rotational invariance brings that 15 down to 10.
Okay, Dave, I think we have to discuss. There are five extra conformal fields, five extra conformal killing vectors, okay? But those are not symmetries of Minkowski space. No. Why?
What? His plane was just slowly five dimensions away. Explain that you recover a Poincaré reaction.
Think what you're using. You're lost on
I understand the country's word.
I don't know. I can. Right. That's right. It has nothing to do with conformal invariance. That's right.
But I'm
not going to write them down. I can go point them to you at some point if you want.
They're not contained in the 15 of the conformal book.
There's a deformation of the for any e. Yes.
Therefore, they must be contained in the 15 generators of the conformal group. Because they're contained in the generators of the symmetry group when E is equal to zero, right?
Minkowski space does not have a conformal symmetry group.
Is there a symmetry which
this is
away when E goes to zero?
No, it continuously deforms back to the usual one.
So it's made up out of some combination of generators of usual.
Yes, but I don't think that has to do with the conformal group. But conformal group, by the way, here is also 15 dimensional, right? There is a conformal group, which is 042, which is the same because it's a conformally flat space. Yeah. But this is a technical point. Let's please have a timeout on that so we can go a little farther. So suppose I do quantum field theory in this case. Okay, I think this analogy is not completely distraction. It's actually worth thinking about a little bit. And it was something that I certainly thought about and influenced some of my thinking here. So suppose we now take a charge field scalar. Let's keep it simple and free. But it could be massive. And we now look at this equation. So again, in this language, if you think about mode functions, and I know you don't like that, but we can look at it many different ways. But I think this is one way to show canonically what's going on. So you can again look at expanding the field. Now it's just plane waves, and depending on the gauge. So for example, there are two gauges I can use. Right? I can use a time-dependent gauge, in which AZ, say, is a linear function of time. Or I could use a static gauge, in which there's no time dependence. But of course, in this gauge, I have a linear potential. By the way, that isn't so different from this situation either, where you can write things in a static way or in a time-dependent way. So if I do it in this gauge first, then the second-order equation this obeys looks like this. So this is just obviously a inverted harmonic oscillator potential. So you get a lot of intuition by just thinking about an inverted oscillator. T, this is a quadratic function of T. And so, and because of the sign, this looks like a potential that's inverted. And basically, you're looking at scattering in which you're above the barrier because that's controlled by this quantity. So you know perfectly well what's going to happen, right? If you look at scattering at this energy level, you're going to be partially reflected and partially transmitted to the other side of the barrier, right? And in fact, if you define a positive frequency function, let's call it Fn, to be that solution of this equation, which behaves like a positive frequency function. Since this is time dependent, I have to write this phase this way. So let's look at that function, which behaves this way in, say, t goes to minus infinity. I call that Fn. And likewise, I can look at the same limit, but as t goes to plus infinity. And I call that F out. Well, because of the reflection coefficient being non-trivial, not surprisingly, these two functions are not the same. But since it's only a simple second-order equation, they have to be linearly related to each other. And you can easily see, by just working with the special functions here, instead of Legendre functions, they're parabolic cylinder functions. But just by working with them, you'll find that there is a reflection coefficient, parameterized by this beta, which means that at late times, the in vacuum contains negative energy particles in this sense, the complex conjugate wave function. And it's easy enough to work out the magnitude of this. Is this. So there is an exponentially small reflection coefficient if the electric field is weak, but non-zero. Then it's a simple exercise to say, okay, this is basically proportional to the probability of creating a pair out of the in state with respect to the out state. And so you can calculate by standard methods the overlap between out and in, and it's basically a product over the K. I'll skip the steps. Like this, which you can promote upstairs to an exponent. And you can go take the continuum limit, in which K just put in an infinite volume. And if you take that limit carefully, you'll get a factor of the volume. And the KZ, in fact, since this is independent of KZ, you have to also get a factor of the time from the KZ integral. So if you do this right, you get something which is proportional to the volume, the three volume, and the time. And you get, therefore, a finite rate. And that finite rate is easily calculated from this. So I'll just, it's a nice formula, so I'll just give it to you. Do this integral by sum. Expanding the log as a sum. Go through this detail just to show you this all is very explicit. And this you will recognize as Schwinger's formula for the decay rate for a scalar boson, charged boson, electric field. He did it actually for the fermion case, so you don't have this alternating signs. And this can be interpreted, you see, as a semi-classical creation rate, where n is telling you the probability of creating one pair, two pairs, three pairs, et cetera, out of the vacuum. And you notice this nice logarithmic and exponential forms, which are very reminiscent of thermal field theory, in fact, because it looks like there's a certain thermal property here, which is the temperature, because, and indeed, temperature is essentially the acceleration over 2 pi. Particles are being uniformly accelerated here. So if I just naively replace that by this, then this, in fact, becomes a thermal-like factor. Okay, so again, it's similar to what you see in the Bunch-Davies state. So in fact, what I did years ago was the analog of this calculation for the sitter, and not surprisingly, when you write down the wave equation in the sitter space, and you look at in the time-dependent gauge, say, in this set of coordinates, not too surprisingly, you find, again, a non-reflectionless potential. There are reflection coefficients, and you can calculate this thing. And by exactly the same arguments, get a formula like this. Where gamma is this gamma. Okay, so.
Verification of the instability is again creating
pairs. Yeah, pairs. So I'm also studiously avoiding the word instability because I'm sure that will open a whole discussion. But
I instability.
Yeah, I mean, if I construct an in state this way, then it means that in state has essentially zero overlap with the out state if I wait a long enough time. It has the same interpretation as in the electric field case.
The electric field case is charged particles. If you did the same calculation for your quantum calculation, it's neutral.
Here, yes.
So what's the analog of the charge? In
the it's the energy momentum tensor. You can calculate the difference.
You have particles in
it's the energy. If you look at this now as a real-time problem, not as an infinite scattering problem, but you start with some initial surface, of course, what you're going to find is the created particles are generating a current. Okay, and the current is in the direction of the electric field. So if I now try to look at back reaction, then there will be an equation like this. So the current is trying, at least initially, to decrease the electric field. This we studied in these initial value problems.
Because the electric field is a problem.
Yeah.
So it's a cosmological constant.
Yeah. So okay. You can calculate the change in the stress tensor between the in and out states, and there is a negative contribution to the cosmological term that way.
Electric field is a field, and the electric field is a constant.
Well,
they're very different things in quantum field theory, and so it's a pretty hazy analogy by fiat carry one over to the other.
Well, I mean, we have to rely on some analogies, right? Otherwise,
constant fields are not a good analogy.
He's saying that the source of the field is being negative.
It's going in the right direction.
The source lives on the boundary. Well, you're saying the source is a term on the boundary that sources the field.
You know, Joe, there are many ways to think about the cosmological term, and some people have formulated it as a boundary condition.
You
don't think of it that way.
The closest analogy to what you're saying for electric field is the Brown tidal buoy question. It's there to screen the cosmological constant in that sense requires not creating particles but entire membranes.
That's different. This is different.
That's not what you're saying.
Yeah.
But you're saying you get a negative contribution if you're going to interpret as.
Well, it goes in the same direction.
This calculation, the field actually has no dynamics.
That's right. We want to talk about interactions.
Calculation, you can take the electric field as a background constant. You think about the calculation, right? You do exactly graphs with this insertion. The photon is not actually complicated.
No, not yet. Right, not yet.
To make the analogy, you're actually need membranes, not particles. That is, in order to suffer something in the background.
That's a different matter.
Are you going to explain why there's a critical mass in the gamma?
Explain. That's a matter of the group theory of this group.
So why is, when a mass is too small, what happens?
We're going to talk about massless things too, I hope. That's the more severe. Just on this remark, at the risk of opening more cans of worms, I just point out that if you take the Friedman equation and the conservation equation and just differentiate this, one of Einstein's equations can be put in this form. So that, of course, if you have zero cosmological, if you have a cosmological term, P is equal to minus rho, and H is a constant. That's a perfectly good solution of the equations. However, if you create matter in which P plus rho is positive, then you would expect H to decrease in pretty much the same way as this equation tells you.
There's another equation around time, which I don't know if it applies to your model, but I'll mention it, which is until very recently in our universe, the cosmological constant was completely disguised by much larger non-vacuum energies.
Possibly, yeah, presumably.
So, it's the current one.
It's the current.
And so this process has to have been happening, you know, not in the distant past, but continuously,
Well, it's a question of time scales then. Yeah. Then it becomes and now we have to talk about interaction.
In running time, when you miss the time scale by a huge, more than 10 to the 20.
Yeah, that's a question of time scale. And that's why I didn't make any, I think there's an interesting indication, but I wouldn't claim this solves the problem. I'm not claiming that. I'm just trying to show you that there are analogies that you can perhaps think about. And of course, if you're talking about spontaneous decay, you see, if you have massive particles and small electric field, this is exponentially suppressed. So the time scale is going to be enormous. Okay. However, gravitational coupling, you know, we can have massless particles in gravity. And so there doesn't necessarily have to be that effect. And that's one point. Second point is, this is a spontaneous creation rate. There, if you had any charges present in the initial state, then those are going to accelerate and produce induced rate, which can be much larger because it can be proportional to the initial density. So, just comments, okay? Not claims.
The time scale is what? 6 gamma? That's
the analog of this time scale, which is, by the way, for a massive field, you can just expand this, and this again becomes like a sum over n, some constants times e to the minus m over th, where th is the Hawking Disintegrator temperature.
So there's also a massless contribution.
Yeah, for the mass, then this all these
questions.
At that time, I didn't consider it because there's a problem with the going to zero mass here. Because then gamma becomes imaginary, and I can't really interpret these formulas.
But so you're saying what is shield, what is canceling the energy density is just the negative energy models.
Yeah. It goes in that direction. It has the right sign. Okay? I haven't said it has the right magnitude or time scale.
So bothers me the case. I can think about this very particle. What that particle is being funneling through this barrier.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a particle here and I have a particle here and they created
I mean, in free particle theory, it's not even sensible to talk about pressure, right? I mean, to calculate the stress tensor. I haven't claimed that yet. I mean, even in this case, and this is one of the subjects of our things we talk about in this program, this is something you can do in the large N approximation. And we did those calculations. I was actually motivated to study these kinds of problems by the gravitational analog. and you find not the electric field going to zero, but you find plasma oscillation. Because you create particles, the electric field goes through zero, overshoots it, then the charges go back the other way. Okay, and it takes a long time for anything to damp out, and in fact, in this approximation, they're not damped.
You mean if you do it under a realistic situation, the field is not in the space?
No, I mean if I just do it in this mean field approximation, in which I ignore photons and only talk about the mean value of the current. So what you need are the interactions with the electromagnetic fluctuations. Then you expect to get some finite conductivity. That's the only way you're going to get a real approach to zero, in, even in this problem. That's a much harder calculation, of course. You're not going to get that in just this mean field picture. You have to put the interactions.
So you have some de Sitter excitation, which you're going to produce.
Yeah.
Well, you talked about the massive case, the massless one, but graviton can probably be included as well.
I want to talk about those.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then those include some expected stress tensor.
I think part of the motivation here was to connect with this recent paper of Polyakov. And I think about half of what Polyakov is saying boils down to this. Boils down to the fact that there are non-trivial mixing coefficients in the Sitter space.
That's just particle production.
That's, yeah. I'm trying to go in something like a logical way, okay? This is a first indication that there's some issue, okay, that you may have to think about. And I think what Polyakov is saying. So let's talk about that.
You mentioned something about comparing the stress tensor in the impact and the outback.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to check, is that the same as saying that if you do what Steve was saying, you compute the expectation value of the stress tensor in the impact, and it's time-dependent evolution?
No.
At the initial part?
No.
Is the claim that the expectation value of the stress tensor in the impact has a trace part which does in fact evolve, so as to partially cancel out?
No, in the Heisenberg picture, the expectation value in the end vacuum is just a constant.
No, the end vacuum is not SO4 on your end, so
But okay, there may be transient effects, but it just goes to a constant. Yeah, that's not the right calculation to do. Okay. No.
So
these are indications. Okay. I'm certainly not claiming that this is a solution. Okay. Okay.
Since this is all this discussion, I want to raise an issue which I hope you'll be able to return to later, which is particle production is controlled by H, the Hubble constant.
Yes.
The Hubble constant is down by the vacuum energy by 2 powers of the Planck mass.
Mm-hmm.
That's the statement that gravity is a super irrelevant interaction.
Right.
Many attempts to understand the cosmological constant run around on just this feature.
Mm-hmm.
That any feedback is suppressed relative to the thing needs to cancel by 2 powers, basically, of the lambda scale over the Planck scale.
For matter fields. If you consider...
This is the general principle. Hubble is much smaller than lambda.
Hubble is smaller than lambda. Hubble is lambda.
No. There's Planck masses in there.
There's no Planck mass here.
Sorry, Hubble. I'm sorry. You're right. Lambda. Hubble is smaller than vacuum energy.
That's right. That is a factor of g newton.
Hubble is smaller than vacuum energy. I'm being careless. And so any Hubble size. The question is, how can any effect whose size is set by the Hubble scale cancel something when you set by this much larger scale of the vacuum energy? Fair question.
That's saying that this is h to the fourth, not h squared.
Yeah, units of Planck.
Okay. So, let's see. I want to make one more point about the electric field, and then this is great. Interesting discussion. But I think the
question of massless particles
and what Polyakov is saying is interesting as well. So, just one more statement,
okay.
And maybe this is provocative as well. Of course, this calculation is done in a particular way in which you assume some initial data and then look at the final data by these adiabatic-like conditions. I didn't have to do that, right? I could have defined a different state. We talked about group theory, but forget group theory for the moment and just think in this canonical picture. It's obvious that the only gauge invariant quantity here is an electric field, which is constant and uniform in time and space. That's time reversal invariant, right? The electric field is T even. So it's pretty clear I could have constructed a state, which is also time reversal invariant. If it's time reversal invariant, it can't possibly have a decay rate. Indeed, there is a Euclidean calculation you can do, because by analytically continuing the electric field in any gauge you like to Euclidean time, you can write it in a way it looks like a magnetic field, right? Just that F dz can go to F tau z with a factor of I, okay? And I know very well, right, you know very well, that a constant uniform magnetic field doesn't create particles, and you can construct a well-defined vacuum state for that, a Euclidean vacuum.
And don't you have a different topology then? It's not S4 anymore.
But here we're talking about the electric field,
right.
Flat space.
Yeah, but we're not.
No topology. Okay. So this is the last point I want to make about the electric field theory. So there is, in fact, a Euclidean vacuum. Now, we can argue about, you know, what Hilbert space it lives in, but clearly by a Fock representation, I can construct it. Okay. And in that state, there is no decay rate, and it's a completely time reversal invariant. So that is indeed, I would claim, the analog of the Bunch-Davy state. It is, however, not usually thought that the existence of that state means that a constant electric field is stable.
Did you raise this question? I mentioned that if you write group theory, that state is not time translation invariant. Of course, there is a time translation invariant state in the same Hilbert space you're using, which is just the one where the electric field is already decayed and the space is still involved.
You mean a vacuum, the ordinary vacuum? But then we're talking about a fixed electric field without the back reaction, right? So just like the fixed de Sitter without any lambda. I mean, that has lambda, right? So.
My point is that E is not time translation variant in this context.
Yes, it is. It's time reversal.
That time translation.
It is. It's constant.
No, you're including a vacuum state.
I think it is.
No, it's going to have particle production in both directions of time.
Yeah, in just such a way that all correlators are time invariant.
You're saying two different things. It's time reversal invariant, yeah. It's not time translation invariant.
I think that I don't know off the top of my head. You can check that.
It should be time translation.
Yeah,
electric field.
I mean, there's no need to break the time translation symmetry either. The background is time translational invariant. So I don't need to break time translational invariance in order to construct a state in Hilbert space. It may look time dependent, but that shouldn't worry me. So there is an analog of Bunch-Davies here.
It's something like where you have a flux of particles coming in,
yeah.
Infinity that you provide.
Yeah, exactly. I fine-tune, if you wish, or I arrange just the right flux to be coming in here so that with the reflection coefficient as it is, it's the same flux going back. So there's sort of detailed balance between the left and right sides of that potential. It looks a little artificial, but
I can do it.
Since free field theory, you can do almost anything, and no one can tell you that that's a wrong state to use. The only thing you could do, and it looks kind of strange, but that's because you have intuition about electric fields that you don't have about the Sitter space, particularly. But
there's another. So let me ask a different question.
All right.
I mean, in this case, we actually know how to create, adequately construct such a state. You think, because we can start with that space, turn on the electric field in the finite region, and make that then region as big as we want. And that's an adiabatic. So what happens if I take the vacuum of that space and do that adiabatically? Which of these possibilities?
Oh, I think you'll find the particle creation. If you turn the field on and off slowly, then you'll find particle creation.
You won't be fine-tuning the flux.
Yeah, because that will pick a certain boundary condition and will rule out this Euclidean boundary condition.
That's okay. You were saying at some point I adiabatically turn this on. At some point it starts to begin. I find it actually impossible to go beyond.
Yeah, except that rate's different.
Well, that's a good example because I can only make E as smaller than one.
Yes.
As I turn it on, there's a maximal volume I can get to at any E.
Yeah, it's important here also that's long.
If I make E smaller and smaller as I make the volume bigger and bigger, there's only one direction that should be something about
it. Yeah, there is.
And which will it approach this?
It will approach this. Yeah. I mean, there are various things in the literature, yes.
It's going to be time reversal, right?
No. If I'm turning it on, I'm breaking time reversal. I'm turning it on then.
Yeah. I can arrange it always so it doesn't decay by making that field weaker and weaker.
But your data, the way you're turning it on is explicitly breaking time reversal invariance and time translational invariance. Even though slowly, you're still breaking it.
You're just saying the decay rate is very slow because it is. You take an E to be very small, so the decay rate is very slow.
You can see the front of it. I mean, your finite volume, then you can make it stable if E is.
If you have a mass gap, you're obviously protected. Because it takes a finite energy to pop them out of the vacuum.
So I make it bigger and bigger. So any region, no matter how big, I can always create a constant electric field. Mm-hmm.
Sufficient.
Remains stable.
Yes.
For a while.
Sure.
You need the distance between the pairs as they pop out to be comparable to the mass.
Right. So at this point, this is very similar to just discussing deforming the Hamiltonian and quantum mechanics that takes a bound state of the presence. Right. And so, you can imagine doing that adiabatically, and the direction in which it continues into the complex plane is really dictated by the direction of time you put into your adiabatic deformation.
You'll never avoid that. That will create a certain definite state. You won't have any choice if you turn it on, right? You'll produce a state.
And the state of
will be not quite, but closer to this with some decay rate than the Euclidean state. I mean, the state will have transient effects, which is not this infinite time.
If finite volume one, with volume less than given by this bound,
the finite volume one, right. Yeah, if you have an electric field and a size that's less than 2m, I guess. Then you can't create any particles.
But in the end, you solve a stationary problem, and then you set up the boundary conditions that give you certain physical interpretation, and you can reverse those boundary conditions in time.
Uh-huh.
So the specific that there are no particles in the past and they appear in the future is just a boundary condition.
Exactly, or an initial condition, if you wish. Correct? Okay.
So I would say that
the only way to resolve, if you knew nothing about what really happens, and of course this is a hard thing to observe experimentally, you have to do something like that adiabatic switching, or if you decide you like this state because it has the most symmetry, you can look at perturbations of that state by interactions, by linear response. That's a very well-defined thing, right? This state has as zero current. Okay, so it's a perfectly good solution of the vacuum Maxwell equations. But then I could perturb the vacuum Maxwell equations and calculate the perturbation of this current. In other words, look at fluctuations around this vacuum. And then, of course, I'm going to get the polarization tensor. This will be the retarded polarization tensor if I do it properly with the initial conditions. So now I'm talking not about the mean value, but about the fluctuations around the mean value from this current-current fluctuation. So this is one way to address what happens. Of course, another way, this is kind of universal because whatever you do, you have to couple to the electric field. That's part of the setup. Whereas you could also introduce particle self-interactions, matter self-interactions, lambda phi fourth, and you could ask how that behaves. Okay. So, but
is the quantity the
same? What? Oh, well, this will have the standard short distance singularities, but that's all. Well, you have to also look at what its long distance behavior is, because you've essentially set up a funny problem here with these boundary conditions. Yeah. In fact, I suspect, I haven't done that calculation, but I suspect that this thing will have long-range correlations that shows up as a divergence in frequency space. And that's, of course, the point. Because if there is such a infrared divergence in this object, then the solutions of this equation will blow up. They will be diverging in time. So that's telling you, if you carry that through and that's the result, that's telling you this state exists, but it's not anything like the real physical state you're going to produce, okay, under perturbations. Okay, so I do want to say now, so now I'm going to turn back to De Sitter space. So about half of Polyakov's paper, thereabouts, is, as far as I can tell, basically making remarks. Here I've done it in gory detail for you, but basically making remarks that are essentially equivalent to this, that you have particle creation in De Sitter space. This is the electric field case, but the De Sitter case is similar. There's a different potential and different scattering coefficients, but there is a non-trivial scattering of in-to-out states. And in fact, if I come back here, this P nu, and this equation is in Polyakov, this thing has two pieces. So if you look at this at large z, for example, so the z, remember, is some measure of invariant distance in De Sitter space. And so this, you can just see, basically corresponds to both positive and negative frequency components. Okay? He also phrases it in the language of sort of single particle Green's functions. Basically, if you look at single particle Green's function in flat space, you expect to have some weighted integral over the path length, right? You can always write the Green's function this way, and the length between two points. And of course, the Minkowski vacuum has this single frequency. It doesn't have any part of a complex conjugate. So the fact that you have these things means, you know, non-analyticity, and usually the usual propagator, that's the meaning of the IF Slank prescription, is that it's analytic in the lower half complex plane in M squared. Okay, that's why you do Euclidean continuation. So here, Euclidean continuation geometrically produces a propagator without that analyticity, without the analyticity in the mass, that, which is actually the reason you do that in flat space field theory.
So this is still gamma real.
Still gamma real, yeah.
So what happened to gamma?
You want to know, I know, and yeah, we're coming, okay? So, and I think this is a nice observation, which is in Polyakov's paper. He says that in flat space, I can mock up this situation by just considering, I have to raise something, by just considering a populated state. The reason, of course, you have positive and negative frequency is because this is not a vacuum state with respect to those adiabatic modes. Right? It has both positive and negative frequencies. That's the way you've arranged it in order to have these nice Euclidean properties. So suppose I look at a populated state. And people in this program know this very well, that if you look at, say, the Fourier transform in spatial momentum of the Green's function of a populated state, just an ordinary flat space now, you get a term which is like this, where this is the distribution function, and you'll get another term like that. So that is exactly the kind of situation we're talking about here, where you have both positive and negative frequencies. And if you try to calculate a Feynman-like amplitude, okay, for scattering, you now start to think about interactions, you're going to get into trouble, because you're going to get terms where this phase factor cancels that phase factor in intermediate integrals, and therefore the intermediate integrals will not behave properly. So he focuses on the composition rule. Normally, you would say that the Feynman propagator should obey a composition rule like this. And of course, it does if I have only one frequency, because basically I just take the product of two things like this, and then it's just the total length integrated over, if I put in an intermediate state here, intermediate time, then basically in the Feynman integral, I'm just summing over the amplitudes to go from here to there and there to there. So this works. Of course, as soon as I have this composition, as soon as I have non-trivial distributions here, this won't work, because what I'll find are cross terms between these two kinds of terms. And in fact, the integral over the intermediate time, let's call it ty, will diverge. Integral over ty diverges and is proportional to f 1 plus f. So if f is 0, you don't see that problem, but as soon as you have particles in the state, you do. Okay. But that's, I think, has a standard, well-known interpretation, right?
What? Times the time.
Yeah, times the time of integration. So it's formally infinite. Of course, we don't expect a scattering matrix to exist in a state in which there are particles everywhere distributed in momentum space. I mean, finite temperature theory, you don't have a scattering matrix because the particle can interact with the thermal bath. It never escapes to infinity. It never produces an asymptotic state. So we know how to deal with that. We don't look at Feynman amplitudes. We look at the Schwinger-Keldysh closed time path amplitudes, which means that you have to talk about a matrix of Green's functions, which is, let's call this one G++, that has the Feynman I epsilon prescription, G minus minus, which has the minus epsilon prescription, and then the Whiteman functions, depending on which field I put first, plus minus and minus plus. So when you do that, of course, you don't. This is not a natural object at all. And if you talk about scattering now in real time, you're going to get additional terms coming from these off-diagonal matrix elements, and you'll get something which is like G plus plus minus terms like this. Okay. And now when you integrate over time, this is finite. It's just telling you that you're not calculating a matrix element for S matrix, you're calculating some kind of in expectation value, and that's what these boundary conditions and the Schwinger-Keldysh stuff is about. Okay, so... No. This is true. So this was just about populated states in ordinary free flat... Yeah, okay. So basically, this tells you you don't have an S matrix. As soon as you have a population, as soon as you have a non-trivial component in the other complex, which is what's characteristic of this factor,
which is
like a thermal state. Right. So he makes those observations. Those are all correct.
However, you know, state is the state you get from the superior attenuation.
Right.
And so why, and you'd think that in the living world I had a well-defined patent rule, where this convolution property would be automatic.
It is indeed in the Euclidean, but once you
analytically
continue, you've gone to a non-compact manifold, and everything is different.
Excuse me, what convolution is automatic in Euclidean? I mean, if I have one particle quantum mechanics, that's one thing, but in field theory?
No, the statement is that if you take the product of two Euclidean, of course it doesn't have the interpretation of a scattering amplitude, but if you take the product of two Euclidean Green's functions, they will obey formally this kind of composition rule. Yes, you're right. Yeah.
The entire Euclidean sphere.
Yeah. But that's a fact, but of no relevance, I would say, in Euclidean space. I mean, because you want to talk about composition rules, you want to talk about real time, right? And then, so it is an amusing and true fact that the Euclidean continuation, which really is based on this I epsilon prescription of M, produces a propagator that doesn't have the properties you might expect. Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. Well, it's one way of thinking about it, right? So you have to give up something. That's the moral. Something is, you either have to give up your analytic properties of the propagator, or you have to do something time dependent.
So it sounds, at this point, it sounds to me like you made very good arguments against the bunch of data.
Really? Okay. I'm happy if you think so, but I'm sure we'll have defenders.
What are the arguments for Bunch-Davis?
Let's let Emil tell us why this is a problem for Bunch-Davis.
Well, I think it's
I don't think he has.
No, I was trying to connect with most of what Polyakov is saying is this.
So are you going to repeat Polyakov's next comment or should I?
I'll talk about massless fields next. That's been...
Okay.
But go ahead. What do you want to say? This is just massive fields. These are just massive fields.
I agree.
Right.
So this is a good place for you to...
Go ahead. Jump on in. It's a discussion.
So, Polyakov comments that indeed this means that the S matrix is divergent and will apply to the consider space.
Mm-hmm.
This is a known fact.
Yes.
With the Bunch-Davis state.
With the Bunch-Davis state, if you like, yes. Yes, treating the bunch. In other words, if you think about trying to do a problem where you think about being turned off in the interaction in the past, started the state in the Bunch-Davis vacuum with a free field, turn on the interaction in the future, and let run for a very, very long time, and you ask what comes out. There's a divergent S matrix in that sense. People often say that the language is confusing because I'm about to use the term out state and in state, which mean very different things than you do over there. If you consider out states and in states in this sense, meaning the state defined relative to, if you like, the bunch of things acting the free field theory that might live in the far past or the far future between the interactions, that the scattering matrix is converging. Great. That might lead you to conclude that, well, it's conditional to Polyakov, but the theory is unstable in some sense. So let me mention that in the case of massive fields where gamma is real, there is nevertheless a well-defined version of perturbation theory that you can calculate that is in fact IR finite. It is not divergent. It merely, and it goes like this. If instead of trying to compute the S matrix, if you're trying to compute the Heisenberg picture field operators by perturbation theory, again, have this picture, you turn off the coupling in the past and the future, and you crank up in a field operator in the interacting region, in terms of the asymptotic free fields in the past, in the future by perturbation, those are coastal curves, and that's all IR finds.
Breaks like the wind calculations and blah, blah, blah.
Just like the calculations that they're looking at.
Yeah.
And what you find is, of course, that if you look at the expectation value of a local field operator, then in fact, correlators are localized field operators. In fact, in the far, if you start the theory in this, in the original Euclidean vacuum and the in-Euclidean vacuum, and you keep correlating the local fields in the far future, which are not too far apart, then they return to their values in the Euclidean vacuum. So in other words, the local physics of the sitter space is stable in one of these massive theories, the sizable mass scale.
Are you talking about free fields, or what? What calculation are you referring to? Just to be
clear,
lambda phi fourth.
For example.
Okay, because Polyglot does make a statement about divergences in lambda phi fourth, so you may have an opinion on that.
Because
I haven't done that calculation.
Polyglot does not do this calculation.
Right.
This is the calculation I'm talking about is the analog of what you do with
your
math,
or
he does the S
matrix.
The S matrix certainly diverges.
Right.
He's pointing out that the local physics is stable. The global physics has this divergence of the S matrix about it. So from my perspective, I see nothing unphysical about this state you started with, this large state you started with. It's just that indeed one has to realize that there are, that because space is infinitely large, you do eventually produce an infinite number of particles, and it takes you to, in some sense, formally a different kind of space.
So what Polyakov discusses, I think, doesn't contradict what you said, is putting a lambda phi fourth interaction and trying to calculate basically an S matrix element of this. And this, of course, is divergent for the reason we said here. Okay. So, yeah, everything factually correct. The question is interpretation.
This is your defense of unshaped.
It's a finite state.
So it's a DC state.
It's a DC state.
Perhaps should not call it a vacuum state.
It's definitely
should call it
a vacuum.
You can call it what you like. It is a, the bunch Davies, you can calculate a bunch Davies state, meaning a Euclidean state, for the interacting theory, yeah, that perturbatively. It's also a finite state. It is SO41 invariant, and it has correlators that can be calculated.
In something like Schwinger-Keldysh.
Yes, something like Schwinger-Keldysh.
No?
And for unlimited time.
No, we have to.
For unlimited time. Well,
the correlation functions
are well-defined. But in the case of this, there's a large mass gap. There are no infrared divergences. There's nothing that in principle
not is to apply. Not the green and then vacuum.
Excuse me?
No, it's just an in-end vacuum. No, it's not in-end, it's just the equation.
There are two things one can do. One can try to compute things in the Euclidean vacuum of the interacting theory, or one may compute something in.
I'm talking about the.
Here's another talk scheduled for this room.
1:30.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately. It's not a bad place to stop, actually. Yeah. And I want to talk about massless field and what's next, but we're not.
Next week.
The program coordinator is already complaining that I'm giving too many talks. Okay. Thank you.